Based on Ben's age and gender, it was likely to be a lone male abductor with a sexual motive, probably acting opportunistically. And how did he come to this conclusion? Past cases? Circumstances of Ben's life and his disappearance? He advised us to look out for someone odd when we were interviewing and looking through statements. Odd? You surely didn't need a profiler to tell you to look out for somebody odd. I don't mean overtly odd. There are signs to look for. Often they're craving control, in sexual relationships perhaps, or just in their lives. Which presumably might have been a fit for your fantasy roleplay suspect? That's right. Describing his work has given him an energy I haven't seen before. I changed the subject, hoping he'll carry this momentum into talking about his personal life. And Emma? What about her? What were her thoughts? To be honest, we hadn't really had a chance to talk properly. She was getting on with the job, though. Fraser was pleased with her. I'm very surprised you hadn't talked. I understood that you were living together. It was hard once the case started. You don't keep sociable hours. When you get home, you're so tired you just want to go to sleep. It was easier for both of us to sleep at our own places some nights, and Emma could be hard to read sometimes, you know? What do you mean? I don't know. You know how people sometimes get very quiet, go into themselves a bit when they're focused on the job? Yes. Well, she's like that. So when she wanted to keep herself to herself, I respected that. And, to be honest, didn't really have time for our relationship once the case started because it consumed us both. It's the nature of it. Do you think Emma was prepared for that? Absolutely. You put a lot of responsibility on her, recommending her for the post. I've already told you I had faith in her. Did you talk about that? I wasn't going to patronise her. That would have been out of order. She didn't need me to. His foot begins to tap a swift staccato on the floor, signalling that he knows it's only minutes until the end of our session. Just one last thing before you go. He raises an eyebrow inquiringly. Did you feel that you were able to keep your distance from the case, personally? What do you mean? The age of Benedict Finch, the visit to his school. Occasionally, when I read your report, I get the feeling that he might have got under your skin a bit. I was professional. I'm not suggesting for a moment that you won't. He stares at me. It's not wrong to care. Was this the first case you worked on where a child was involved or in danger? Yes. Was that hard? It was hard in that we had to find him. It was our responsibility to him. He'd done nothing wrong. He was just a kid. But that didn't make any difference to anything I did. Do you think your response to the case could have been affected by the relatively recent death of your father? What? Sometimes when we lose a parent, it makes us reflect on our childhoods. It's not an uncommon response to parental bereavement. That might have made you more vulnerable to identifying with Benedict Finch and what could be happening to him. He doesn't reply. He looks incredulous. Did I, Clemo? No, it didn't. You got the wrong end of the stick. I was doing my job. Isn't this session supposed to be over by now? Although there's a clock in plain view on my desk, he glances at his watch. It's obvious that he's not going to engage with this today.
Day 4. Wednesday, the 24th of October, 2012. Crimes against children, particularly cases involving abduction and homicide, continue to be problematic as both a social phenomenon and judicial responsibility. Such cases routinely receive intense community, media, and law enforcement attention and can rapidly overwhelm local investigative resources. Boudreau, M.C. Lord, W.D. Dutra, R.L. Child Abduction. Aged-based analyses of offender, victim, and offence characteristics in 550 cases of alleged child disappearance. J. Forensic Sci. 44, 3. 1999. Stay united in your fight to find your child. Don't allow the stress of the investigation to drive a wedge into your family life. When emotions run wild, be careful that you do not lash out at or cast blame on others. Remember that everyone deals with crises and grief differently, so don't judge others because they do not respond to the disappearance in the same way you do. When your child is missing, a family survival guide. Missing Kids USA Parental Guide, U.S. Department of Justice. OJJDP Report. Email to Corin Fraser, FraserC@aspol.uk. CC James Clemo, ClemoJ@aspol.uk. Giles Martin, MartinG@aspol.uk. From Janie Green, GreenJ@aspol.uk. 24th of October 2012 at 06:58. Operation Huckleberry, Press Review, 24/10/12. Morning, Corin. Roundup of this morning's press coverage relating to Operation Huckleberry below. This is just the nationals and locals. Due to the vast quantity of material, we've yet to go through everything that's online, so I'll forward that later. As usual, highlights below with link to scanned copies. I'm copying this in to D.S. Martin at his request. The material is concerning him, and he'd like us all to get together later this morning to discuss tactics. He and I can do 10 or 11. Janie Green, Press Officer, Avon and Somerset Constabulary. The Sun Newspaper. Angry. Blood. On her hands. Rage. In her eyes. Gashed. Across her forehead. The Daily Mirror. Blood on her hands. Loner photographer mum says on her website she likes to work alone. Neighbor says she never saw Benedict. The Daily Mail. Do we need to look any further? Could the answer to Benedict Finch's disappearance lie close to home? Rachel. I slept only fitfully after looking online. The phrases I'd read repeated in my head over and over again. When I woke up for what felt like the 100th time, the stormtrooper clock beside the bed read 4:47 a.m. Ben's bedding was twisted around me, and I felt exhausted and cold. Nikki was sleeping in my room, with the door open. I didn't want to wake her. I crept downstairs quietly and didn't turn any lights on. On the kitchen table, I found her laptop. I opened it, and the glow from the screen lit up my fingers, poised over the keyboard. It asked me for a password. I watched the cursor blinking as I tried to think what it might be. I knew it wouldn't be the name of any of her daughters. She'd lectured me once on password security and the foolishness of using your children's or pets' names. I tried Rosedown, which was the name of the cottage we grew up in. Incorrect password was the computer's response. I tried Rhubarb Custard, a reference to Nikki's blog. It didn't work. I had one more shot at it, and no clue what to try. On a whim, because it was my password in spite of her advice, and because my exhausted brain couldn't come up with anything else, I tried Benedict. It worked. I leant back in my chair in surprise, but then I felt a rush of affection towards Nikki. My bossy sister, a proud enough auntie to use Ben's name as her password. Now that I was in, I searched Benedict Finch missing. News items from all different sources appeared on the screen. The story had exploded. Images of me from the press conference appeared alongside Ben's photo. My bleeding head, my white pallor, my body language and my angry eyes. Many of the news headlines were blatantly aggressive towards me. But I still couldn't help myself. Like a moth to a flame, I clicked on the Facebook site. There were hundreds of posts. The top one was from somebody called Kathy Franklin. Kathy Franklin. The mother has done something to him, that's obvious. 2 hours ago. Like. Stuart Weston. Police wouldn't have let her talk at press conf if they suspected her. 2 hours ago. Like. Kathy Franklin. Stuart, that's not true. Has been seen before that people crying in press comps have been convicted. About an hour ago. Like. Rich Jameson. Some people hang themselves like that. Perhaps they're trying to catch her out. You wouldn't believe how many people have done this. Go to www.whereisbenedictfinch.wordpress.com. You'd be amazed. 42 minutes ago. Like. 6. Write a comment. I clicked on the link. My heart was pounding, my mouth bone dry. The page appeared instantly. Web page. www.whereisbenedictfinch.wordpress.com. Where is Benedict Finch? For the curious. Facts. Posted at 03:14 by Lazy Donkey on Wednesday, the 24th of October, 2012. Benedict Finch went missing at 15:30 on Sunday, the 21st of October. The last person to see him was his mother. She let him out of her sight, and she never saw him again. Yesterday, she appeared at a press conference to appeal for help finding Ben. This blog wants to draw your attention to some things that have happened in the past. Case histories. Ian Huntley. This man appeared on television shortly after the disappearance of Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman. He was later convicted of their murder. He was the last person to see them alive. Shannon Matthews. Shannon's mother appeared on television on numerous occasions after the disappearance of her daughter. She was later convicted of her kidnapping. Tracy Andrews. This woman appeared at a televised press conference to appeal for help finding her fiancé's killer. She blamed a road rage incident. She was later convicted of murdering him herself. What do these things tell us? They tell us that nothing is what it seems. Comments. 54 people are discussing this post with 94 comments. Kathy, _07926. I'm very troubled by what I'm reading here. Why don't we all stop persecuting the mother? Have any of you ever heard of innocent until proven guilty? Jen loves cookies. Kathy, I agree with you. As a human being who lives and breathes, I want to hold out my hand to Rachel and Ben and the father so they know there are people out there praying for them and their little boy. I was awake all night thinking of them. What that family must be going through. Selena Y. OMG, you only have to look at that mother to know she's done something. She is guilty until innocent for me. Get real, everybody. How else will we stop evil scum hurting our kids? Mountain biker. Why did the mother let her kid run off like that, asking for trouble? And what about the father? Julia Peachy. That dad is a doctor. Save my baby girl's life. Heart goes out to him at this time. John Doe. A kid running alone in the woods, seriously. Did she want something to happen to him? That's out of a nightmare. Joker_864. Trees can walk. Ivy wraps around your feet. Branches carry you up and away. Little finches are prey for bigger birds. Rich Nix. I wouldn't want her for my mum. Scared me. Cloud99. She shouldn't be allowed a kid. It's disgusting what she did. You don't realize how stupid people are till you read this stuff. A child is a gift. I wouldn't let my kids run off. Doesn't she know the risks? House Proud. I feel sorry for Benedict Finch with that mum. I hope his dad can take him after this. Forever 21. As a mum of four, I would want people to stop speculating and start praying for that little boy. Rational_dawn_2_dusk. Speculation is a drug. It fuels our society. Happy in my dressing gown. People need to stop being sat in front of their screens and get out there and help look for this little boy. Police should give us more information. Whatever the mother has done, we must pray for God to protect this poor little boy, wherever he is. The kitchen light came on suddenly. Nikki was standing in the doorway. She looked crumpled and sleepy in her nightie.
What are you doing?
I gestured to the laptop.
Who would write something like this? Do you know what they're saying?
She took a quick look and pushed down the lid of the laptop.
Don't look at it. You mustn't. There's no point. It's sick people using Ben to get their moment. It's grotesque. It's a feeding frenzy. Promise me you won't look again. Promise me. It's not just people. It's the newspapers, too. Promise me you won't look.
I promised, but my hands shook for a long time afterwards.
Jim, I spoke to Emma before I left for work. A quick call because I'd missed her the night before. She answered the phone quickly. Hey, how are you? But I could hear the drag of fatigue in her voice, and she yawned generously. Good. You? You sleep well? What do you reckon? I reckon you're awake half the night like me. I was. You okay? I've survived on less. Everyone on the investigation's going to be feeling it. I know. She still sounded flat. I didn't like it. Because it wasn't like her to let things get to her. I wanted to buoy her up. But it's what we do it for, isn't it? A case like this? Yes, you're right. If we get a result, that is. She stifled another yawn, apologized for it, and then she snapped back into something resembling her usual efficient tone, as if she'd suddenly realized how dispirited she sounded. I was worried about you yesterday, she said. What do you mean? With the press conference, Rachel Jenner out of control and the whole country watching. Don't be obtuse. I didn't really want to answer that. I'm fine. Are you sure? If I say I'm sure, then I'm sure. Okay, good. Sorry, I'm not fully awake yet, I don't think. I overslept. Didn't mean to upset you. Can I give you a quick call back in a few minutes when I finish getting ready? I'm on my way already. I'm literally about to step out of the door, so I'll see you at the briefing. Okay. I'll see you then. I'll be more with it by then, I promise. We said our goodbyes. They were affectionate enough, but I ended the call feeling a bit cheated, because the conversation hadn't lifted my spirits the way I thought it would. At work, our priority for the morning was to go and talk to the member of the fantasy roleplay group, who had already given some difficulties to the pair of DCs who went to interview him. First thing in the morning, checks had thrown up some previous on him, indecent exposure no less, meaning that he'd just shot straight to the top spot on our interview list. DCI Fraser stuck to her guns by insisting that she'd like to talk to him herself. We'll see this young chappie in his home, I think, Jim, she said. But let's no book an appointment, eh? We'll surprise him. It was a long time since I'd been accompanied to an interview by a senior officer, and I tried to fight off the thought that she wanted to keep an eye on me after the balls up at the press conference. More likely, I hoped, she was living up to her reputation as somebody who liked to stay in touch with the roots of her investigations. She asked Woodley to come along too. We took an unmarked pool car. I drove, and Fraser studied the stereo, glasses halfway down her nose. Woodley sat in the back, but took the middle seat and leaned forward each time Fraser said anything. Fraser asked, "Did you see the email from the press office this morning?" "I did. Pretty brutal. Indeed, I'm meeting D.S. Martin about it at 11, and he's not going to be a happy bunny." D.S. Martin was the officer ultimately overseeing this case, and Fraser's senior officer. He was never a happy bunny. I waited for her to say more, but she turned on the radio. "What'd you like to listen to, Jim?" she asked. "Five Live, usually, boss," I said, "or Radio Bristol." "Those are very pedestrian choices," she said. "How about a little culture? Have you ever heard of culture, D.C. Woodley?" "Well, I played the recorder at school," he said. I glanced in my rearview mirror. He had a deadpan expression. Hard to know if he was taking the piss. Fraser looked amused. She put on a classical music station, turned up the volume. "I would have had you down for Radio 4, listener, boss," I said. "No, no, there's far too much danger of hearing one of our pals from Scotland Yard crucifying himself and the entire force on Radio 4. I like to avoid that if I possibly can." She leaned her head back on the headrest, and when I glanced at her, as we stopped at the traffic lights, she had her eyes closed. We turned up at the address at 0900. Our man lived in a basement flat, in a shabby street in Cotton. From the looks of it, the street was mostly student flats, which had been carved out of a terrace of tall, flat-fronted Victorian buildings. The bath stone facades had probably been attractive once, but were now dirty and cracked in places. Not a single building looked well looked after. Wheelie bins littered the pavements, or were crammed into the tiny areas that fronted the street. Most of them were disgorging overstuffed black bin liners, In front of our man's property, a bin for food waste had tipped over and deposited its rank contents on the threshold. "Not a proud household, then," said Fraser, stepping carefully around the muck in a pair of little heels. We had to repeatedly press the buzzer to get an answer. Our man eventually buzzed us in through the communal door, and we waited in the hallway for him to appear. Fraser flicked through the post that had been dumped on a communal table. Food delivery flyers littered the floor, and these, together with Fraser's shoes and lipstick, were the only sources of colour in the drab place. The light was on a timer, and clicked off just as he inched open the door to the basement. "Edward Fount?" asked Fraser. He nodded. Fraser introduced us. We produced our badges, and he squinted at each one in turn. He was a slight man, with very pale skin, and hair so black that it must have come out of a bottle. It fell in greasy tendrils around his face, and made him look feminine. He lived alone, apparently. There were only three rooms, his bedroom, a corridor that was pretending to be a kitchen, and a room that must have been a bathroom, if the smell coming from it was anything to go by. "They don't like him," Fraser had told Woodley and me before we left. "The organisers of the fantasy meetings, the ones we've spoken to, they're wary of this boy. He's a new member, and they don't know him well. And on top of that, nobody saw him leave the woods on Sunday. Some of them say that he doesn't play by the rules, which is a cardinal sin in roleplay, apparently. Some of them complain that he's dirty, too." He was dirty. His body odour was powerful even before we stepped into his squalid bedroom, which had only one small window through which you could see a small section of the backyard. All concrete and the winter carcasses of rampant self-seeded buddleia plants. The bed was a single, with bedding on it that had probably never visited a laundrette. A desk, roughly constructed from bits of MDF, was the centrepiece of the room. It had a PC on it, and a dusty iPod dock which cradled his phone. Music was playing. Celtic-sounding, lyrics in German, wasn't mainstream. The walls were covered with posters and artworks depicting dark and bloody fantasy worlds. Edward Fount sat down on the side of his bed and was unafraid to study us intently from behind his fringe. Fraser took the computer chair, adjusting it for wobble before she settled on it, crossing her legs. I saw Fount's eyes run down her calves and linger on her shoes, which were a dark maroon patent leather. Woodley and I stood against the wall. There weren't more than a few feet between us all. "Is that window open?" said Fraser. Fount shook his head. "It's painted shut. It doesn't matter. It's always cold down here anyway." "You need ventilation," she said, "or you'll get sick." "I take vitamins," he said. A feeble gesture indicated a tube of vitamin C tablets on his desk, beside a warped black plastic tray with the remains of a microwave meal in it. "Well, that's good," said Fraser. "It's important to take care of yourself." Fount nodded. "Especially, I'd see," she continued, "when you're out doing battle every weekend. Would I be right?"
"It's not every weekend," he said. "Once a month. And it's not always a battle. It's a narrative, a storyline we enact."
"Narrative's a very grown-up word, Mr. Fount, and so is enact. I'm impressed. So tell me, what character do you play in these narratives? I understand you all develop roles for yourselves. Would that be right?"
"I'm an assassin," he said.
He knew she was toying with him now. There was nothing stupid behind those furtive eyes, but still he couldn't disguise the pride in his words.
"Uh-huh, and would assassin be an important role in the game?"
"Very. It's very, very important. The assassins lie in the shadows. They watch. They wait. They know secrets."
"Do they now?"
He nodded, his chin up, trying to assert confidence.
"And would an assassin have a lot of power?"
Her voice lingered mockingly on the sibilance.
"Yes."
"Would an assassin be a match for a big man like, say, D.I. Clemo here?"
"Assassins have their methods. They're afraid of nobody, and everybody fears them."
"That's very clever. Good for you. By the way, are you not curious to know why we're here?"
"Is it because of the boy who went missing?"
"You've shown a remarkable lack of interest. Why is that?"
"It's nothing to do with me. I didn't see anything."
"What happened to Benedict Finch wouldn't be one of your secrets, then?"
"I never tell my secrets."
"And why is that?"
"Because they're secret."
He laughed, a quick high-pitched sound of fish gulping air.
"What is it, perhaps because you're ashamed of them? You have a previous conviction for exposing yourself, don't you? I can understand why you'd like to keep something like that under your hat, or should I say, under your assassin's keep. Probably wise."
"I never did it."
"That's not what the two little girls who are trying to play a nice game of tennis said." "How old do you think they were?"
"I'll tell you. They were 11 years old, and their nice game was interrupted by you sticking your wee tadger through the netting around the court, was it not? It's not how it was, I promise.
Fraser leaned forward, fixing her gaze on Fount.
Did you see Benedict Finch in the woods on Sunday afternoon?
Fount shuffled his backside across the bed until he was sitting with his back against the wall. He had a sharp Adam's apple and angry ingrown hairs along his jawline. He said nothing, but there was a defiance in his expression.
So, did you? Asked Fraser.
See Benedict Finch in the woods on Sunday afternoon?
She hadn't looked away from him.
Fount crossed his arms.
I only answer to the authorities of my kingdom, he said.
Fraser snorted. You got three authorities in the room with you now. How much more authority do you want?
I only answer to the authorities of my kingdom.
How about, how did you get home from the woods on Sunday? Nobody saw you after 3 o'clock.
You don't understand. I inhabit the kingdom of Iskar. I recognize the Iskarian authorities only. Assassins answer only to the knights of Iskar, the holders of the hammers of Hisuth.
What? What nonsense is that? You'll answer to us. Let me tell you something. You better grow up, young man, and you better do it quickly. We're investigating the disappearance of a child here. There are two facts we can't ignore. You were there, and you got previous.
She stared at him until his eyes dropped. He picked at a frayed hole on the knee of his jeans.
Can you tell us anything about what you saw? I asked, inserting my words carefully into the stalemate that was brewing, although I felt like wringing his scrawny neck. It would be very helpful.
Fount closed down his face. He wasn't going to talk.
If I find out later that you know something that could help with the investigation and you're not telling us, then you'll pay for that, said Fraser. She got to her feet. Have no doubt about that.
Right, we're finished here for now, but we're certainly not finished with you. You can see yourselves out, said Fount to Fraser's back.
There was a hint of a smirk on his face. We paused at the bottom of the stairs when we realized Woodley wasn't behind us. He waited in the doorway of the room.
Iskar,
he said to Fount.
Isn't that an ancient tribe from Nordic mythology?
It's the finest tribe, said Fount. It's the most noble.
Sounds fascinating. Is the game very complex?
Woodley sounded impressed.
To play properly, there's a lot you have to understand.
Awesome, said Woodley.
He said it simply, his voice light.
See you again, maybe.
He nodded at Fount, a man-to-man gesture.
Bye, Fount said to him.
What a prick, said Fraser. It's meeting pricks like that that make me actually look forward to getting back to my desk.
I knew that wasn't true. However high she climbed, at heart, she was a street cop through and through. We were in the car. Woodley and I had pulled on our seatbelts. We were ready to leave. Fraser was taking a few moments to rage.
I bet he wishes he was still sucking at his mammy's breast. What you reckon?
I think we need to be careful. He's almost too much of a cliche. He looks so good for it on paper. Young, single, male, all of that. But I think we need to be careful not to make assumptions about him.
She ignored me. You know as well as I do that if there's a cliche, there's usually good reason for it. Christ! That little prick's giving me a headache with his skanky flat and his self-obsessed smug little bucket and spade ideology. He needs to get out of the sandpit and get into the real world. Knights of Iskar, what's that about when it's at home?
She sighed. She looked tired. She was putting in the hours this week, just like everyone else.
I suppose it makes a change from asking for a lawyer.
I feel like I've got something in my eye. Have I got something in my eye? Fraser pulled down the mirror, pulled down an eyelid.
I don't think he did it, I said.
She flicked the mirror back up brusquely.
What makes you say that?
I agree that he looks good for it on paper. But he couldn't take his eyes off your legs in there, and your... I felt shy suddenly.
My what?
D.I. Clemo.
Were your shoes, your red shoes.
Oh, right. Well, for the moment there, I thought you were going to say something else.
Woodley snorted from the back seat, and then tried to turn it into a cough.
So what's your point, Jim?
My point is that somebody interested in children is not usually interested in women. Especially not in a fetishistic way. He couldn't take his eyes off the red shoes. I was watching him.
I still want him brought into the station. We can't possibly rule him out because he looked at my shoes.
You know that as well as I do.
Woodley, I saw what you did at the end there. It's very smart. When we bring him in, I want you to interview him and get to the bottom of his dirty little mind, whichever way it bends.
Yes, ma'am.
I could hear the sound of a grin in Woodley's voice.
I'm no your ma'am, she said. Boss will do.
Right, come on, Jim, what are you waiting for?
Rachel. Halfway through the morning, Nikki announced,
I've spoken to John. He wants us to go round to his house so we can agree together on a design for a missing flyer and print some there. He's got a laser printer.
I'd never been to John and Katrina's new house. Not past the front door, anyway. I'd spent plenty of time standing on the gravel outside when I'd dropped Ben off for the weekend. Will Katrina be there?
I expect so, yes. But at this point, I think you need to think of her as another pair of hands. She wants to help, and we need all the help we can get.
I thought of the blog and the comments I'd read this morning. Any port in a storm? I said.
Exactly, she said,
and she smiled just a little. It pleased Nikki when I said that, because it's what our Aunt Esther used to say.
You'd been through a storm, she would say,
if we ever discussed the circumstances that had led us to live with her.
A terrible storm, and I was your port.
A safe haven, Nikki would say, and Esther would agree. Esther had taken us in after our parents' death. She was our mother's much older sister. She brought us to her house immediately after the accident that killed our parents, and we never left after that. She sheltered us from gossip, which sometimes hung around us like a cloud of biting midges. She gave us the chance to have a childhood, or her version of one. It wasn't a usual upbringing, because Esther was a spinster who'd always lived alone. She taught English literature A-level to the children of the local wealthy at a small private school and could quote a huge amount of poetry by heart. She also played bridge and had a passion for growing roses. She wore knee-length skirts and flat shoes with simple cardigans and had bobbed flyaway white hair that she clipped back with Kirby grips. She kept gold-topped milk in the fridge, which the birds had invariably pecked at before she brought it in the morning, so each lid had neat puncture marks in it when it arrived on the breakfast table. I don't think Esther was a naturally maternal figure. She was unaccustomed to young children, apart from a regular annual visit she'd made to our family before our parents died. So when Nikki and I arrived suddenly in her life, she treated us as miniature adults and shared her passions with us. She surrounded us with art and music and books. She pointed out the possibility of beauty in life. Nikki drank this up as if it were nectar and fell into Esther's arms gratefully. I was different. When I was growing up, I always felt like the baby that I'd been when we arrived there, a bit of an addendum to their lives, too little to understand things properly, always in bed when the proper conversations took place. It was ironic, as I'd never known our mother or father, that I was the one who found it most difficult to accept Esther in her role in loco parentis, while Nikki, 9 years old when we arrived, wouldn't leave her side. As a teenager, I'd meanly thought that Esther was fusty, tweedy, and better suited to another era, more like other people's grandparents than their parents. I'd rejected her gentle offerings of culture and knowledge because they hadn't immediately bolstered me or given me an obvious direction or purpose. That came later in life, when I took up photography, when I sat beside John in St. George's Concert Hall and fell in love with him and with classical music. And then I regretted that I'd never thanked her for what she did for us before she died. It was because things hadn't always been easy when we were growing up that it pleased Nikki whenever I said a kind word about Esther. It pleased her immensely. I agreed to go to John's house. Laura came round to house-sit, because I still couldn't stand to leave it empty, just in case. Nikki and I had to fight through the journalists to get to Nikki's car. They jostled us, shouted questions at us. We ignored them, but the questions hurt. They were aggressive. Accusatory. Some of the photographers ran alongside the car as we pulled away, lenses at the windows, snapping away at our white, scared faces. John and Katrina's house was only 10 minutes' drive away, on a quiet suburban street where everybody had driveways and two cars parked on them at the weekend. The house was semi-detached, Art Deco in style, painted white, and had long linear windows along the front of it, which would normally give a view into both their sitting room and office. When we arrived, the curtains were drawn in both rooms, and there were journalists lounging on their low front wall like teenagers at a bus stop. They leapt to their feet at the sight of us. John opened the door and ushered us in quickly. He looked dishevelled, and he was unshaven.
"In the kitchen,"
he said.
"John," I said, before we stepped out of the hallway. "I'm so sorry about the press conference. So, so sorry. I didn't mean to..."
"It's okay,"
he said.
"At least you didn't just cry like a baby."
It hadn't occurred to me that John might be berating himself for his own behaviour. I thought mine so much worse.
"Don't be ashamed," I said.
But he was already on his way into the kitchen. Before I joined him, I couldn't help noticing the parquet floor in the hallway, and remembered what Ben had said about it.
"There's a shiny floor, but I'm not allowed to skid on it."
Katrina stood in the kitchen beside a small round table. Like John, she appeared haggard and undone somehow. She was dressed in jeans, a t-shirt, a cardigan over it. She looked very young. She glanced at John as if expecting him to play host, and when he didn't, she asked,
"Can I get anything for you? Would you like a cup of coffee, or water, or tea?"
It was awkward being in their house, I can't deny it. But together we made a flyer, and in some ways it was a relief to have something constructive to concentrate on. Ben's photo was prominent in our design, as was the phone number to contact. The word "missing" ran along the top of the page. The plan was to print out 100 copies there and then, and Katrina said she would get more done at a local print shop. She and Nikki discussed how and where we should distribute them. When we were done, Nikki said,
"John, Katrina, do you mind if I ask, can either of you think of anybody who might have done this? Anybody at all?"
John's reply was curt.
"I've told the police everything I can think of."
"Are you sure you can't think of anything odd at all? People behaving strangely around him, anything like that?"
Katrina said,
"We've gone round and round in circles talking about this, haven't we, John?"
He had his elbows on the table, his hands flat on its surface. It was almost a position of surrender. He nodded at her.
"We have,"
he said.
"And I can't think of anything."
His eyes were so bloodshot they looked painful.
"It's the teaching assistant I wonder about,"
said Katrina.
"He only started this term," I said. "I don't know anything about him."
"Exactly," said Katrina. "That's what bugs me. We don't know who he is. He's an unknown quantity."
"Have you spoken to him?"
I asked John.
"No. You?"
"Not once. He's never out in the playground."
John shrugged.
"The police will be talking to everybody,"
he said.
"They've assured me of that. I don't see what we can do."
"Anybody else you've thought of?"
Nikki asked. John had had enough.
"Don't you think I haven't spent every second of every day going through this in my mind? I can't think of anything else that would help. God knows I wish I could."
He slammed the flat of his hand down on the table and it juddered.
"Of course,"
Nikki said.
"I'm sorry."
In the silence that followed, Katrina stood up and began tidying up mugs. My eyes roved round, taking in John's new home. Their kitchen was white and shiny, the granite surfaces immaculate. The only sign of disorder in the room was a large pinboard covered with stuff. I stood up and went to look at it, lured over there by one image in particular. It was a drawing made by Ben. The drawing was of three adults and a child. Each person was named underneath. Mummy, John, Katrina, and Ben. We all stood equidistant from each other. Ben stood between John and me. My family, he'd written above it, and on each of our faces was a smile. And in that moment, I realized that Ben had managed to do what I hadn't done, couldn't do. He'd moved on. I began to cry. I felt an arm around my shoulders. It was Katrina. And what she said next made me realize for the first time that she had a heart and feelings of her own.
"Would you like to see his room?"
she asked me.
"Yes."
She took me upstairs. On the landing, the first door we came to had three colorful wooden letters on it that spelled out Ben. She opened it, and I stepped inside.
"Take as long as you like,"
she said. She went back downstairs. The room had been beautifully decorated. It was light and fresh, with pale walls and striped bed linen. The bed was made up with care. The duvet had been smoothed and tucked in, and somebody had carefully arranged three or four soft toys against the pillows, which were plumped up and welcoming. The walls were hung with two framed pictures of Tintin book covers, Ben's favourite ones, and a Minecraft poster. There was a child's desk in the corner, and on it a stack of scrap paper, a container full of colouring pens and pencils, and a lamp, bright red in the shape of an elephant. A half-finished drawing lay waiting to be completed beside the iPad that John had given me the day before he left us, but which had ended up belonging to Ben. It had felt impossible for me to deny him that, in the absence of his father, and he often left it at John and Katrina's house so that he didn't have to negotiate with them over computer use, because there was only one in the house. A large rug covered the floor, and there was an electric railway set assembled on it, a train with carriages attached, ready to depart. A light shade, patterned like the moon, hung in the centre of the room, and from it, carefully suspended on a thread, one above the other, hung three homemade paper aeroplanes. I sat on the bed for a long time, until John appeared in the doorway.
"This room is lovely."
I wanted him to know that.
"Katrina planned everything with Ben. She painted it herself."
There was no reproach in his voice, which he might have been entitled to. Just a dreadful sadness. I could see that an extraordinary amount of care and attention had gone into the creation of the room. It was painful to me to hear that Katrina had done the work, but not nearly as painful as the fact that Ben had never once described it to me.
"It's beautiful,"
I said. And I saw suddenly how I'd taken everything Ben told me about his life at his dad's and twisted it into a sordid, unhappy shape. No skidding on the floor had meant that Ben wasn't allowed to play, and that wasn't the end of it. Every time Ben had come here, I'd festered at home and questioned him afterwards, mining him for information that I could use to paint their marriage, and especially Katrina, in a negative light. I'd never allowed for the fact that Ben might have been happy here, that John and Katrina might have made an effort to make things nice for him, that she had, in fact, welcomed him with open arms. Everything my son had told me, I'd taken and made into something unpleasant or sad, until he'd simply stopped telling me things. He was a sensitive child. He knew what upset me.
"I'm so sorry,"
I said to John, and he said,
"I am too."
I heard in his voice the self-blame that was my companion too.
"I keep thinking about how scared he must be without us,"
I said.
He misses you even when he's here. So God knows how he's feeling.
Do you think he knows we're looking for him?
I'm sure he does.
They were words of reassurance, but John's eyes told a different story. I read in them a quality and depth of despair that matched my own, and that frightened me even more. When we got home, Nicky and I decided to park the car a few streets away and see if we could approach the house via the alleyway that ran along the back, avoiding the press pack. It was a narrow passage, not wide enough for a car, and occupied mostly by rubbish bins and foxes. It separated the ends of our gardens from the allotments behind. From it, you could directly access my garden studio, where I did my photography. Once in the studio, it was only a few meters across the garden into the house. Our garden wasn't big. There was just enough room for a small football net and a swing ball set. Our gamble paid off, because the journalists hadn't bothered to camp out there. As we squelched along, avoiding puddles, we saw it at the same time. On the fence panel facing my studio door, somebody had been busy with a can of spray paint. In scorching orange letters, neon bright against the dull grey slats of wood, dripping in places because it was so fresh, two words had been sprayed. Bad mother. When I sank onto the sodden, stony ground in front of the panel of defaced fencing, grit digging into my hands and my knees, Nicky knelt down beside me and coaxed me up. She took me indoors and phoned Chang.
Who would do such a thing?
I asked Nicky. But she just shook her head and lifted her hands in a gesture of, who knows? It boiled over. The fear and the anger, the frustration and the terrible impotence I felt too. I was being persecuted. It was personal. And that was terrifying. And it wasn't just in cyberspace, it had come to visit me at home. Some of my anger was directed at myself, because of Katrina, because I'd got it so wrong about her and John, because I'd been so bitter and so stupid that I'd forced Ben to lie to me. At 8 years old, he'd felt he had to protect me from the fact that they had a nice life together, that they cared for him. But my anger was mostly directed at whoever painted those words, because it made me feel very, very afraid. In my kitchen, in front of Nicky, I threw a plate across the room and it shattered into pieces across the wall. Another followed it, and then a mug, some cutlery. I threw everything as hard as I could, and then I looked for more things to throw.
Don't!
Shouted Nicky.
Don't do this, please!
She manhandled me. She took hold of me, gripping my upper arms. She sat me down on one of the kitchen chairs, and she knelt on the floor in front of me.
Where is he?
I asked her.
What's happening to him?
Don't,
said Nicky again, her voice quieter this time and her face close to mine.
Please don't.
I stopped resisting her, and I sobbed until my throat was sore and my eyes were swollen almost shut.
Jim. Fraser and I had a pre-meet before the whole team got together for the evening briefing. She was looking at her computer screen as I took a seat. Woodley's bringing in our friend Edward Fent of Fantasy World fame in the morning, she said. And Christopher Fellows, the forensic chappie, has sent me a profile that we can use when we're considering the non-family abduction option. You'll not be surprised to hear that it's an almost perfect description of Mr. Fent. I still think he's not our man. She took off her reading glasses to study me. I know that, I take your point, but I can't dismiss him on a hunch. This isn't an episode of Columbo. In spite of everything, that made me smile. Columbo had been a favourite childhood show. Fraser went on. Can we run through who else we're looking at? Rachel Jenner? Chris emailed me his thoughts on her. He's been a busy boy today, which is good, because he's expensive enough. He should have copied me in on that. Can I see it? I got the email up on my laptop, winced a little in anticipation of her reading the first paragraph. Email. From Christopher Fellows, cjfellows@gmail.com, to James Clemo, clemo@aspol.co.uk, 24th of October, 2012, at 3:13. Re Rachel Jenner. Jim, thanks for your email. Good to hear from you. I've had a chance to watch the footage from the press conference. Would it be terribly wrong of me to say what a colossal balls up? I hope it's not your neck that's on the line for that one, but somebody's ought to be. We'd worked up a good script for her. What a waste. You wanted me to pull together some thoughts about Rachel Jenner as a potential suspect. Seeing as we don't yet know whether this is an abduction or a murder, I think the way forward for now is to keep in mind that these are very different crimes which throw up differing motives and therefore profiles. I've detailed these for you. Family abduction. In my view, this is only a small possibility in this case because in the vast majority of family abductions, a mother taking a child would keep the child with her, and both would travel somewhere where they felt the father would not be able to reach them or harm them. However, it is worth looking into whether other family members might have helped her to conceal the child in order to keep him away from his father. Family abduction by a parent almost always takes place after a divorce where custody arrangements are disputed. N.B., I am not excluding the possibility that another family member, i.e. somebody who is not a parent, could have taken Benedict for motives of his or her own that don't relate to the ones I've outlined above. That would be a separate scenario entirely. Filicide. Much more complicated, this. Generally, there are a few different motives, not all of which are relevant to this case. The two most likely to be relevant to Benedict Finch's disappearance, in my view, are as follows. Accidental filicide, stroke battering. Usually an impulsive act characterized by a loss of temper, often occurs in context of psychosocial stress and lack of support. Did she lose her temper with him in the woods, or perhaps before they left home and hid his body somewhere en route? Mentally ill filicide. Complex, this one. Filicide often seems like a rational act to these women, older children more likely to be victims. A large percentage of these women are already known to the social services or mental health services and have pre-existing diagnoses that could include melancholia, manic depression, schizophrenia, or assorted character disorders. Munchausen syndrome also worth considering here, in which case the family would certainly already be known to medical services, though probably unlikely if dad is a medic. Worth mentioning also two other categories, mercy killing, a murder committed out of love, usually to spare a child's suffering, which could be caused by disease or perhaps the potential loss of a mother if the mother herself is contemplating suicide. It's not unusual for a parent or parents to take their own life simultaneously in this scenario. Spouse revenge filicide. The killing of a child in revenge for something, often infidelity. The aim is to get back at the spouse. Please bear in mind that these are first thoughts only, but they should give you something to go on. I'd be on the lookout for custody disputes, previously existing psychological or psychiatric issues, previous involvement with social services, mother's predisposition to suicide, revenge impulses pertaining to her husband, did he cheat on her? And check out her support network. No doubt you've done many of those things already. I would need to come and meet Rachel Jenner if you want to progress these any further in terms of getting a detailed psychological picture of her. On the basis of what I saw in the press conference, she certainly possesses the capacity for uncontrolled outbursts of anger and a potential impulse for revenge, i.e. her threats to Ben's abductor. Of course, none of this rules out the possibility that the perpetrator of this crime, whether it be abduction or murder, is a non-family member, which D.I. Fraser and I have spoken about. I'm currently formally writing up my thoughts on that and will send directly to D.I. Fraser and CC you in on. Please give me a call if you'd like to discuss. Best, Chris. Dr. Christopher J. Fellows, Senior Lecturer in Psychology, University of Cambridge, Fellow of Jesus College. Forward it to me, please, Jim, she said once she'd read it. There's some good stuff in there. I'll let it and pass on to the rest of the team. We should also take note of his point about the wider family. The sister interests me, but that's all the wider family there seems to be. There's also a friend,
Laura Saville, who Emma's met at the house. Has she been interviewed? Not yet, but she's a priority. And on top of that, the school have sent over a very long list of people that Ben could have had contact with. Anybody stand out? I met with a head teacher and Ben's class teacher. They were obviously stressed out, but trying to be helpful. The head's a little defensive, I'd say. It's obviously a nightmare for him, especially because he's only been on the job since the beginning of the school year. They raised one or two concerns about Rachel Jenner that you already know about. You mean the broken limb that the child had? Yes, but I can't see any evidence of wrongdoing there. I do think she's been depressed, though. That's pretty clear. And it might be the most significant thing from our point of view. Teacher. Late 20s, I'd say. Eager to assist. Perhaps not the sharpest tool in the box, but seems perfectly nice. They're behaving like people struggling to cope in a difficult situation. Understandably. The only one who rang a few alarm bells was the teaching assistant. He's got an alibi, doesn't he? He does. The head does, and the teacher does, and they all check out. So what rings bells for you? He was just a bit shifty. Woodley thought so too. Who interviewed him formally? Can't remember off the top of my head. Did they raise concerns, do you know? Nope. Do you want to interview him yourself? No, it's only a feeling and I don't want to spook the school unless we've got a very good reason to. The headmaster sent over the full list of people Ben might have had contact with yesterday evening, and I think we should wait and see what that might throw up. There are at least 20 people on it, so I'll take time to check them out and interview them. But let's leave the teaching assistant alone until we see what comes of that. Agreed. We don't want another witch hunt on our hands. It's bad enough already. By the way, have you seen the blog? Blog? But she was looking at her watch. We should go. People need briefing. I'll talk about it in the meeting. We walked into a packed briefing room and took our seats. Prominent at the head of the table was D.S. Martin. Don't mind if I join you, do you, DCI Fraser? He asked. He had an unusually low voice. His presence at the meeting was a sign of how high profile the case was. He wore full uniform. His hair was curly but thinning, so it looked like spun sugar. He had slab cheeks and a drinker's nose. He reminded me of some of my dad's friends. He was on his way to a function at the Marriott Hotel, he told us, so he couldn't stay long. His presence was a downer. It gave the meeting a formal edge, took away the conspiratorial atmosphere that Fraser usually managed to foster. She kicked things off. First bit of news was that there'd continued to be a high rate of calls to the tip line, so she was pleased about that. Fraser talked people through progress and shared our thoughts with the room, told them about the stuff Chris Fellows had sent over. She divvied out the workload and allocated actions. Priority was given to trawling through the list that the school had provided. "Speak to as many people as you can," she said. "We need to form as clear a picture as possible of the networks around this child." Fraser asked for updates, and a sharp-faced DC called Kelly Dixon started us off. She told us that she'd located the paedophile. He'd been at a comic convention in Glasgow on Sunday afternoon, manning a stall. He hadn't been anywhere near Benedict Finch. He had, however, crossed paths with an incalculable number of under-16s during the course of the afternoon, a clear breach of the terms of his release, and as a result, he was cooling his heels back in the cells. "Jesus," said Fraser. "That's a result of sorts, anyway." The next item was the blog. If things had been bad for Rachel Jenner up to now, then it turned out that they were about to get worse. "It won't have escaped anybody's attention," said Fraser, "that our victim's mother behaved in an unconventional manner at the press conference yesterday."
"Understatement," boomed D.S. Martin.
Fraser tried to contain her irritation. "That behaviour seems to have triggered somebody to write a very vindictive blog, which aggressively targets Rachel Jenner, implying that she is responsible for Ben's abduction, or worse. Woodley, would you like to explain?" Woodley cleared his throat. His mouth was dry when he spoke. Nerves. "Normally we wouldn't expect a blog like this to attract very much attention," he said, "but the author has placed several links to it on Facebook, which has inevitably led to it being shared and mentioned on Twitter and retweeted over and over again. It's had thousands of hits." He looked at Fraser, who said, "In English, please, for the older generation." "It's gone viral," he said. "Still none the wiser," she said. I saw Emma smile discreetly. We all knew Fraser was more IT savvy than she let on. But there were others in the room who might need this spelled out. "Well, everybody's looking at it. Thousands of people already, with the potential for it to spread to tens of thousands." Fraser continued, "Right, which means it's a possible problem for us because it could stoke people up, and the last thing we want is trial by internet. We must remember, in spite of her performance in front of the press, we have no evidence to suspect that Rachel